It's Monday, November 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, a huge last-minute push for votes is made ahead of the U.S. presidential election on Tuesday. We check on polling station preparations and what the candidates themselves are doing.
It's making a lot of people sick because this oil is burning.
Islamic State burns oil fields as Iraqi forces draw nearer to liberating Mosul. Also ahead, a school tragedy is the focus of a new documentary. It's all on today's International Edition. National surveys continue to show Hillary Clinton, a former U.S. Secretary of State, with a narrow edge over Donald Trump, a blunt-spoken real estate mogul seeking his first elected office. Most polling analysts are predicting a Clinton victory on Tuesday, but her advantage over Trump is not insurmountable. Collections of recent national polls show Clinton looking to become the country's first female president with about a 2 or 3 percentage point edge over Mr. Trump. U.S. presidential elections, however, are not decided by the national popular vote, but rather in the Electoral College, where the results are tallied in each of the 50 states and the national capital, Washington, D.C. The biggest states have the most electors in the Electoral College. Both Clinton and Trump need a majority of at least 270 of the 538 electors to win. In the latest development, FBI Director James Comey has told Congress he has not changed his conclusion, reached in July, that Hillary Clinton did nothing criminal in using a private server for emails while she was Secretary of State. That issue has been a campaign flashpoint for the past year. Comey made the announcement Sunday after reviewing a new batch of emails discovered during an unrelated investigation. He gave no other details of what was in those new emails other than to say that the Bureau has not changed conclusions expressed in July with respect to Secretary Clinton. A Clinton campaign statement reacted by saying it is glad that the matter is resolved. Days before the election, in small and large counties across the United States, local offices are gearing up for the final push to Election Day. Jeff Swikert takes a look at Democratic and Republican activities in two counties near Washington, D.C.
There are few undecided voters left, so the focus of both campaigns is to motivate less enthusiastic supporters to get out and vote. Matt Gammon is a campaign strategist with WPA Research in Washington, D.C.
Really what you're looking at is a lot of folks who are on the fence or maybe have already made up their mind, but you're not sure if they're going to vote, or they haven't made up their mind strongly for one candidate or another.
At the Anne Arundel County Republican Party in Pasadena, Maryland, volunteers are gearing up to turn out voters.
A waving a rally sign.
County Coordinator Faith Loudon has prepared shopping bags full of materials for precinct leaders to take to the polls. She says informing voters about Republicans down the ballot is critical.
Usually when people go to the polls, I'd say sometimes as much as 30% of the people can have their mind changed by a positive person waving and greeting them at the polling place.
Gone are the days of large rooms full of phone banks calling people to get out the vote. Facebook now plays a larger role.
So here is one that we put up earlier.
Jerry Cave with the Montgomery County GOP says phone banks can reach thousands of people, but with Facebook, campaigns can reach millions.
This provides us an opportunity to energize our people to get out the vote, and it's working, as you can see, because in the early voting in Maryland, on the first day of early voting, Maryland had 62% more people vote that day than they did 4 years ago.
At a meeting of the Arlington County, Virginia Democratic Committee, attendees are signing up people to greet voters at the polls. Democrats are taking a slightly different approach in the final days. Phones and social media are important, but Democrats are knocking on every registered voter's door in the county right up to Election Day, Tuesday. Congressman Don Beyer, who represents Arlington County, is running for re-election.
Arlington will also do a good job all day Tuesday of looking at who hasn't come to the polls yet. And right up till 7 o'clock that night, they'll be still calling people and knocking on people's doors to make sure that every possible person can get out and be part of this.
According to estimates, early voting is greater than the record pace set 4 years ago. Jeff Swikert, VOA News, Washington.
As the final and frantic push for votes concludes, VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman joins us in the studio to discuss what the candidates are doing to make sure that they become the next president of the United States.
Jim, Donald Trump is making five stops today in five different states, campaign stops. Hillary Clinton is only making two, but she has some star power on her side. Yesterday, there was Katy Perry, and she will be campaigning tomorrow with President Barack Obama. This is indeed the final furious chapter of an election process that really began a year ago.
Oh, I mean, it feels like it.
Presidents serve for four-year terms, but really the presidential campaign cycle is about a year long. It's in the fall of the previous year when all the candidates announce. For some, I suppose it's excruciatingly long. For political junkies, maybe it's just long enough. But I suspect that many people will go to the polls on Tuesday, cast their votes, and be glad that this particular cycle is coming to an end.
Unlike in many other countries, this is a particularly long cycle. And you really do get a sense, I guess, through this of what the candidates are like, their personalities. We've seen both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump go off in many different directions over this period of time.
We have. And it's interesting to look at the polling data of the last few weeks. There was the revelation from the FBI that they were looking into a new batch of emails, and the polls very much tightened last week. There's new polling data out in the last 24 hours that suggests that Clinton may have recovered a little bit of the lead that she had before. But we're still talking 4 points in an NBC poll, 5 points in an ABC poll. And that's still within a margin where if one candidate outperforms in terms of turnout or underperforms in terms of turnout, where the election could still be decided. This is not in the bag for Hillary Clinton by any means. But when you look at the map, there are certain things that have not changed. There are states that Hillary Clinton can afford to lose, toss-up states, battleground states, that Donald Trump simply cannot afford to lose. If you look at the math, it's almost impossible to see him clawing his way to victory if he doesn't win Florida. Hillary Clinton could lose Florida and still win the Electoral College. It's hard to see how Donald Trump claws his way to an Electoral College victory without North Carolina. So from Hillary Clinton's perspective, you could lose either of those states, win one of them, and essentially her path is pretty much a sure thing. The way that I look at it is, imagine with all these battleground states, the challenge for Trump is to toss heads 6 times in a row. That's possible. Mm-hmm. Randomly, you could toss a coin and get heads 6 times in a row. But if one of those goes tails and one of those states goes to Clinton, then her path to the electoral votes, the electoral college votes, is looking very bright indeed.
Yeah, we talk about 4 percentage points, but these are nationwide polls, and Al Gore in 2000 will tell you the popular vote doesn't mean anything in that sense. And the math just doesn't seem to add up for Donald Trump at this point. I've seen several electoral maps out there that said, oh, here's a possible way he could do it, this, that, or the other. But as you point out, one state pretty much will sink his chances.
That's true. I would say that there is one wild card, and I wouldn't have given much credence to it except for the actions of the Clinton campaign in the last 24 hours. They have scheduled a visit to Michigan in the waning hours of the campaign. Why they would do that, why they would suddenly be concerned about Michigan, which is pretty much as blue an upper mm-hmm. Midwest state mm-hmm. as they get, it almost lends credence to the idea coming from the Trump campaign that there is a hidden working-class white vote for Trump that is just waiting to come out and vote for him. I don't know that that's the case, but arguably, if Trump wins, say, Ohio, and were to pick off one of the states that everyone assumed was safe for Clinton, whether it's Michigan, whether it's Wisconsin— mm-hmm. either of those states, then all of a sudden Donald Trump's possibilities grow to a certain degree. I think that your average betting person would be well advised to place their bets on Hillary Clinton. But look at the year that we've had. Look at all the unbelievable things that have come to pass. Look at all the polls that have been wrong in so many states and so many instances. I don't think that any person who puts out poll data is entirely confident of what the numbers are suggesting.
Well, no matter the bet, one sure thing is the payoff comes Tuesday, and many of our questions will finally be answered, including the most pressing one, who will be the 45th president of the United States? We know who our VOA Senate correspondent is. That's Michael Bowman. Mike, thanks for stopping by.
Always a pleasure.
Well, time now for our social media segment with International Edition's G. Abby Lee. She's also right here in the studio with today's trending stories on the web. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
What do you have for us?
It's a love story involving three penguins. But if you thought it's going to be a cute one, I hate to disappoint you because it's actually quite tragic. National Geographic posted a short clip of a bloody penguin fight on its Twitter, and it sent people into a frenzy. The encounter is very jarring, but I have to tell you the reason for the fight is even more jarring.
Uh-oh, what is it?
So, over the course of the 3-minute clip, it describes a love triangle between a husband, his wife, and a homewrecker. And they fight for a little bit after the husband finds his wife with a new guy, and then calls on the wife to decide who she wants to stay with. And lo and behold, she chooses a homewrecker. That's when the fight really intensifies and gets bloody.
Well, animations like Happy Feet made us think penguins are just happy-go-lucky.
I know. Wow.
What's the social media like to this?
A big shock, not just at the level of violence, but also because penguins are supposed to mate for life. So some people are saying if penguins cheat, there is no hope for humans. Others are pointing out the fact that husband is still pleading for the wife to come back after she chose a homewrecker and tweeting, "No, homie, you deserve better."
All right. Well, enough of the penguin drama. Mm-hmm. What else happens to be trending?
The 40th annual New York City Marathon. So runners from all over the world gave it their all to compete in the event that encompassed 5 boroughs. People are also talking about the daylight savings time, which started Sunday.
Oh, yeah. I had to set my watch back to briefly explain. It's the the practice here in the United States and other countries of setting the clock forward by an hour during the warmer part of the year so that evenings have more daylight and mornings have less.
Right, which our audience don't have in Asia and Africa. North Americans woke up on Sunday with an extra hour, and people are joking, "Hey, if you thought you were going to be late for church, no, you're actually early." That's all for me today, Jim.
Extra hour of sleep, as they say. Well, thank you for the wrap-up, G. You may follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our individual accounts are found at VOA Stevenson and at G. Abby Lee. Among the top stories in Asia, U.S. military says counter-Taliban action very likely caused civilian casualties. British Prime Minister eyes stronger trade ties with India post-Brexit. Delhi announces emergency measures to combat dangerous air pollution. Tens of thousands take to the streets to protest against South Korea's president. Advisors point to key differences between Clinton and Trump on China policies. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the voanews.com website and through our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. As the front lines of the battle against Islamic State move into Mosul, the surrounding areas are in tatters, with smoke from burning oil fields coating the sky of some of the areas for months. VOA's Heather Murdoch talks to residents about trying to recover from Islamic State rule alongside the fires in Giara, Iraq.
Islamic State militants set oil fields in this city on fire before they were forced out of the area 2 months ago.
After they left, soldiers say timed bombs remained, and when the bombs went off, the fires were reignited.
Some people say the fires were meant to hide IS from airstrikes. Others say the group is just bent on destruction. All agree it's a crisis that is not being addressed.
They destroyed this well of oil 3 months ago by bombs. This is hurting us by the smoke. It's hurting our chests.
it's making a lot of people is sick because this oil is burning.
While this fire rages on freely, there is another burning oil well in view. Locals say it is technically being put out, but it's been months with no change. In the meantime, families near the fires live in homes encased in smoke, and it blocks the sun over entire villages and towns.
The situation is very dangerous. The children get up in the morning and their faces are soon black. Even the furniture is black.
Families say the defeat of Islamic State in their area was a great victory, and a list of the names of those killed by the group hangs on a shop door in town. But the devastation IS left behind has left many homes empty, and those remaining say they feel like they are living in a fire. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Giara, Iraq.
More on the story can be found at our website, voanews.com, where you can also see video for that story. Be sure to also follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
On Tuesday, November 8th, all eyes will be on America as voters choose the next U.S. president. Tune in to our live comprehensive coverage with our correspondents around the country and around the world. Starting Tuesday at 2200 hours UTC GMT and continuing through Wednesday morning right here on VOA.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. It has been nearly 4 years since 20 children and six educators were gunned down at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. VOA's David Byrd tells us about Newtown. It's a new documentary that looks at the effect the massacre had on the small town and the country.
John, 911, what's the location of your emergency?
Sandy Hook Elementary School, 12 Dickinson Drive.
Okay, what's going on down there?
I believe there's shooting at the front glass. Something's going on.
I want you to take cover. Jen, get everybody you can going down there.
It's still happening.
The film opens with the horrified voices of people calling 911 to report the shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. The new documentary, Newtown, uses first-person interviews with some of the victims' families, neighbors, and co-workers to tell the story. Mark Barden's son, Daniel, was one of those killed.
I still have a little secrets stashed around. He used to wear this old yellow football helmet when he'd ride in the little seat in the back of my bicycle. And I have that in the garage, and it still has some beautiful little long blonde hairs of his in it.
In one scene, Nicole Hockley, whose son Dylan was also shot, shows a room stacked with boxes of condolence cards, gifts, and other items from well-wishers.
This is most of the stuff that's been, I don't even know how many thousands of letters and gifts and portraits. So many of them have never been opened because I just can't do that yet.
Kim Snyder, who also directed Welcome to Shelbyville about Somali refugee immigrants in small town America, is Newtown's director.
And we felt we had not seen a film like this that had really looked at the trajectory of up to 3 years. We filmed over the course of 3 years. Sadly, there's been so many since, but I think Newtown for so many people was a watershed moment and really needed to be, you know, we needed to bear witness to that so that with the hope that that something could change.
Maria Cuomo Cole is the film's producer. She says that the filmmakers wanted to remain sensitive to the pain community members were in, but also wanted to highlight the bravery and endurance shown by Newtown.
Kim and I felt it was extremely important to be as sensitive as possible, of course, in telling this important story, a story that, you know, we don't have the luxury to forget in America.
It's, you know, it's hard stuff, but it's part of who we are. And hopefully, you know, we can learn from it and create change to keep communities safe.
Do you promise to live life to its fullest?
I do.
Do you promise to cherish family and friends?
I do.
The film takes a hopeful turn when it shows community members taking part in the Daniel Barden Mudfest, an endurance race that benefits several charities. Nicole Hockley has also been able to go into the room of condolence gifts and to start opening some of them. The issue of gun control has been hotly debated in this year's presidential campaign. Maria Cuomo said her hope is that Newtown will touch people's hearts on both sides of the issue and will result in change. That change has still not arrived. Earlier this year, the deadliest massacre in modern U.S. history took place in Orlando, with 49 people gunned down at a nightclub. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. There's so many different ways to listen to our program. One way is just to go to our website at voanews.com, where you can stream us or download our program. Also check us out on Facebook at VOA Now and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. We'd like to remind you that Tuesday is Election Day here in the United States. It might be Wednesday morning where you are. No matter, we'll be on the air nonstop to bring all of the latest results to you and find out who our 45th president will be. Thanks so much for joining us. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Aydin Utku. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When it comes to humanitarian aid, one of the greatest achievements of the past quarter century is the fact that since the early 1990s, the number of undernourished people who live in the developing world has dropped by just short of half, from 23.3% to 12.9%. But the improvement, though impressive, has been uneven, with great regional differences. In fact, some areas, many of them suffering from overpopulation, conflict, or deep, inequitable economic growth, have actually gotten worse. So, in developing the Office of Food for Peace's Food Assistance and Food Security Strategy for the next decade, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, incorporated the lessons it has learned from the successes and even failures of the past 25 years. One of the more successful ways food assistance programs can tackle chronic hunger and poverty is by looking beyond food, wrote Dina Esposito, director of USAID's Office of Food for Peace, in a recent blog post. This means looking at food security from all angles and asking the right questions, such as how did families earn incomes to put food on the table? How much food did families produce on their land, only enough to feed their families? Or were they able to sell crops, too? What were the causes of malnutrition in the communities? The primary goal of the 2016 to 2025 plan is to improve and sustain food and nutrition security in vulnerable populations. USAID's Office of Food for Peace is working to achieve that goal through a two-pronged approach. One works to meet immediate needs and strengthen capacities that protect and enhance lives and livelihoods. The other works to strengthen local systems for longer-term sustainability in key areas impacting food security. There is unprecedented consensus that building the resilience of vulnerable communities, including their food and nutrition security, is key to our larger goals of ending extreme poverty, enhancing stability, and spurring economic growth, wrote Director Esposito. Through the development of the new strategy, we reaffirm our shared vision of a world free of hunger and poverty, where all people live in dignity, peace, and security, and together set out an ambitious goal for the next decade to improve and sustain the food and nutrition security of vulnerable populations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.